Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Lee Hutchison.
And welcome to the Senate floor.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this next edition of the filibuster here on the Senate floor. We're so glad that you're able to join us today. Today, Lee, we're going to take a step back. Usually we're talking about what's coming out currently or things that are happening, you know, at the moment. But 2016 is a special year, not just for the year for the movies that are coming out this year, but also for the movies that are having anniversaries this year. And today we're going to talk about one of our favorite films that just happens to be turning 30 years old this year. We're talking about the second installment of the Alien franchise, James Cameron's 1986 classic sequel, Aliens.
Damn right. As soon as this Alien Day was announced a few months ago, I was badgering Matt. I was like, come on, we've got to do an Alien, something special for the Alien Day. So I don't know where this idea of an Alien Day has necessarily come from. It seems like an excuse to sell some Reebok shoes, but any opportunity to get it back in the cinema for a day is an opportunity I'll take.
Hey, I'm okay with that. I mean, like, because let's talk about that for a minute. So I don't remember this ever being a thing before, Lee. Is it just this year that this started?
Yeah, I think it's some sort of promotional day. I know there's the Reebok shoes coming out, and I think it's kind of snowballed from there. It seems everyone's kind of got on board with it. I know Mondo, who do amazing geek prints, they've released some jumpers, prints, such like for the day. I know the Alamo Drafthouse in America is doing a lot of Alien and Aliens events here in the UK.
And I was wondering why it was specifically 426 until someone pointed out to me, oh yeah, the planet in Aliens is LV-426.
Yeah, it seems like a perfect opportunity, doesn't it?
It does, except for you, it's a little bit backwards because we do the whole date thing differently than you do.
Yeah, we do it the right way, and you guys in America, it's kind of worked out well for you, but we've all just jumped on board with this Alien Day too.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing here in the UK. Nearly all the three kind of big chains here, View, Cineworld and Picture House, are all doing Alien and Aliens on Tuesday, when we're hoping to have this podcast out for, give you something to celebrate. And so it's pretty much every single cinema in the UK at 7 o'clock on Tuesday will be doing Alien Director's Cut and then the Aliens Director's Cut not long after. So I think for a lot of people, it'll be their first time of seeing it on the big screen.
See, I wish it was that way here too. I mean, I don't think the major chains here are doing it. The independent movie house here in town is showing the first Alien on Alien Day.
Oh yeah, it's so, I've seen it quite a few times live at the cinema over the years, Alien and Aliens. I've seen digital cuts, I've seen old film copies, and that was quite badly deteriorated at points, but still had that kind of charm. So any opportunity, I've never seen Aliens and Alien the Director's Cut on the big screen, so it's still going to be a good, unique opportunity for me on Tuesday.
That's going to be fun. So you're attending that. I'm attending the first one. We'll have to report back. I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun. But we're talking, you know, a lot of people like to talk about the first Alien, and the first Alien is quite groundbreaking, and it was something different. It was obviously the beginning of Ridley Scott's career. It's the beginning, really, of Sigourney Weaver's career.
Yeah, it certainly kickstarted a lot of people's careers.
Yeah, for sure. The success of that movie, you know, it was really big at the time. But it must have been a different environment where sequels didn't come out immediately afterward, because we waited a good long time. The first Alien was 1979. We don't get Aliens until 1986.
Yeah, and it was certainly worth the wait. I mean, that's the big debate everyone seems to have, is what's your favorite, Alien or Aliens?
Now,
and
let's have this out front, Lee. What is your favorite? Because mine is, I love the first movie, I really do, but my heart is with Aliens.
It's trying to pick my favorite child. I think I'd go more towards Alien now. When I was younger, I was Aliens in Aliens in Aliens. While, as I've got a little bit older, I've kind of swayed more towards Alien. So that would be my favorite one. But it's a pin hair. They're both so radically different, but they're just so incredible. I think the fact that I've maybe seen Alien a few more times on the big screen has given it a bit more of a special place in my heart. But yeah, Alien just pips it for me.
I see. It is like picking children. I think I go more with Aliens only because I like the faster pace of it. And I like, yeah. You know, I love the cast of Alien, don't get me wrong, but we're going to talk about this movie for the next hour or so, Aliens.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things about Aliens is the crew of characters that we're with during the whole movie. And so I think that just edges it out for me. There was a summer, I think it was the summer in between my first year of university and my second year of university, where I did nothing but watch, like, Alien, but especially Aliens, like, on a loop.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, why I got into it that summer, but I did.
It's such a great movie. I've been lucky enough one time to see it as Alien. I watched an Alien Day at my local indie cinema, where it started with Prometheus, then Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, and then Alien Resurrection. So I think I kind of used Alien Resurrection as a kind of sleeping time, and I'm pretty sure I was kind of gone by that stage.
That would be Alien 3 for me.
Oh, you better not tell Tristan. He'll be after you for daring to tackle the Mr. Fincher.
He already knows. I pretend Alien 3 never existed.
Like, for me, Alien Resurrection doesn't exist, and then Alien Requiem, and Alien vs. Predator.
Well, those movies, but I don't even know what those are. You're speaking nonsense to me.
They're absolutely atrocious, but Alien 3, I was discussing this with a friend last night when we were out. I was like, Alien 3 isn't a... It's a very flawed movie, and I don't think it's a film I enjoy particularly watching. There's aspects of it I really enjoy and respect. I'm more interested in the behind-the-scenes information, really, on Alien 3.
Yeah, me
too. The documentaries on the anthology set are second to none that movie. Yeah. So it's given it a kind of second life. I think the ending with Ellen Ripley sacrificing herself is incredible. Slightly undone by... very much undone by Alien Resurrection for packing a punch. So Alien 3... it's okay, but it's not one I ever go, man, you know what I'm in the mood to watch tonight? Alien 3.
Well, the problem is that... And I don't know if you'll agree with this or not. We're not talking about Alien 3, but in relation to Aliens, mm-hmm. Aliens being my high point of the series... I mean, if you have an emotional attachment to this film, Aliens, like I do, then Alien 3 is... It may not be a bad movie on its own, but it's the worst possible follow-up to this movie.
Yeah, I think what probably me and you both love so much about Aliens is the cast, and that's something that Alien 3 really pisses all over, and it really... it gets off to a bad start, that you get so invested in these characters, and for you can almost understand the idea behind doing it, but it really is a kick in the face when the characters we've really backed and supported are, like, minutes later in the grand scheme of thing, if you watch it as a trilogy, are just kind of wiped out.
I really think that soured me on the whole film, the film opening with Hicks, Newt, and Bishop being dead.
Yeah, I mean, we get a bit of a glimpse of Bishop later on, but
it's the most depressing glimpse you'll ever see.
For sure. I know that Sigourney Weaver this week was saying that there's still some hope left for the Alien movie that she's been working on with the District 9 director.
Yeah, Blanca.
So I'm quite excited about that. I almost picture it as a Sliding Doors companion to Aliens, where Alien 3 is what happened if the ship, say, crashed. This Alien movie could be about what happened if it carried on. So people have been kind of down on it, thinking, well, that kind of pisses all over Alien 3.
Hey, I'm fine with it. You know what? I'm good with pissing all over Alien 3.
But for me, I think we're all sci-fi fans. We can think quite big and broad. So I have this image of it as just a Sliding Doors, that Alien 3 is still alive as one option of what happened after Aliens. Now, this potential movie could be it. You know, another one, just a split in the road. Both films can exist co-inhabitably. It's not one or the other, as far as I'm concerned.
Right. But we're not here to talk about Alien 3. Let's talk about the good sequel. Let's talk about Aliens.
Yes.
So, when was the first time you saw this movie, Lee? Did you see it before or after you saw the first one?
I think I saw it quite a few years after. Alien, I witnessed when I was maybe about 7 or 8. I had... obviously, I was a huge Star Trek fan as a kid, as I've alluded to a few times before. And anything to do with aliens was just, I'm cool with that. So I noticed a movie called Alien one night on the TV. So I put the video in the VCR, set it to record at that time, and it recorded. So then a few weeks later, I went to my grandparents to stay the night, and I brought this VHS that I'd recorded and just started watching it. And I just vividly remember that opening credits, just the alien word coming together. It wasn't a movie that I particularly appreciated as a 7-year-old. I think I got a bit bored with it.
It's a bit more slower paced, but once that film gets going, it really gets going.
Yeah. Like, I was just too young to really appreciate Alien at the time. And then Aliens was obviously a few years later, and I remembered the VHS cover, and it was just, it had aliens on its side, and then just this alien covered in blue, and I just thought, oh man, that looks really cool. I recognised Jim Cameron because obviously Terminator 2, I think, was one of my dad's favourite movies in the 90s, so I was kind of familiar with a lot of the names. So I was like, well, I've got to get this VHS, and I loved it. It was everything, like, you know, a boy around 10, 11 would just die to watch. Just, I didn't know what was going on half the time, but I was just loving the non-stop action, and it was such an adrenaline rush for a young guy.
It really was. I saw it kind of around the same time you did, back when I was 12 or 13. I was really starting to get into horror. As you all may know, I'm a big horror movie fan, but I was very limited at the time with what my parents would let me rent from the video store, because, yes, it was back in those days. Mm-hmm. One of the, you know, parental-approved choices was Alien, the first Alien. Mm-hmm. Because they knew I liked sci-fi, and they knew it wasn't, like, psycho killers, so it wasn't exactly quote-unquote real, so I could watch it. So I rented it, and I ended up really loving that movie. Like, I just was so jazzed by it. Yeah, it's definitely a slower paced movie. It takes a while to get going, but once you hit that dinner scene with John Hurt and the chestburster, it really takes off from there.
Yeah, like I over the years, like, obviously it wasn't for me maybe as a young kid, but Alien just, it grew and grew. Like, the older you got, you appreciated it more, and just even as a work of art, it's something that you appreciate. It's a fine wine of a movie, and it's rarely been bettered, and it's been imitated many a time since, you know, with diminishing returns on the franchise itself and outside. And it's so unique. But Aliens is one of those movies that as soon as you watch it the first time, you're jazzed up. That's what James Cameron did so well at that time, that he could create movies, and it was like almost down in a can of Red Bull. You were as amped up as any colonial marine.
Yeah, I mean, it was great. So I was gonna say, so I watched the first movie and really loved it, and, you know, when the next week when we went to go to the video store again, I could rent one film a week, and so I had to get Aliens. So mm-hmm. I saw them about a week apart for the first time. And
what was your initial reaction when you first watched it?
Yeah, it was pretty much the same as yours. I was immediately in love with it. Now at 12, you don't get all of the crude jokes and all that stuff when you don't have like that sophisticated sense of humor yet. But I knew I was loving these characters for a reason. And
what really... sorry.
What were you going to ask?
No. Carry on. My apologies.
I was just going to say that it blew me away even as a little kid. And then, you know, I watched it off and on for a little bit. But then, like I said, it was between my first and second year of university that I got back into the franchise. And I watched the first two movies, but especially the second one, on just a loop. And at that point, at 19, I was really getting into James Cameron, too, because that's mm-hmm. that summer was the first time I saw the Terminator movies. So I was really getting into him and his aesthetic and rewatching Aliens and just falling in love with it all over again. So I would say that I fell in love with it when I was 12, but I was like ready to marry it when I was 19.
One thing I always loved about Aliens was it kind of linked in. I had got like the PlayStation 1 at the time, and one of my favorite games was the Alien Trilogy game for the PS1. And, oh man, it was so cool. And I remembered always just getting the heebie-jeebies from the beep of the scanner.
Yeah.
Beep, beep, beep,
but,
beep,
but
beep, beep.
I mean,
and like, I think those, I would almost...
I would say, oh, like, out of all the games that are made for movies, like the Alien games, they're actually like legitimately frightening.
Yeah, and I was working with someone a few months ago, and I went around to their house, and like they had it, the PS1 game. I was like, oh my god, like this game was one of my favorites as a kid. So that kind of tied into the movie, and I can't quite remember if I played the game first or then I watched Aliens, which I think was the case. I can't quite remember. And I just remember just loving that game, and it complemented the movie so well. The tension was just so awesome. And then to see that, when you see the Colonial Marines looking through the base, and you're just like, oh my god, it's just like the game.
Right. I mean, it was just so perfect. I don't know how many of our listeners need us to go through the film, but basically your down and dirty synopsis is it takes place 57 years after the first movie, and Sigourney Weaver's Ripley is found in her shuttle, is finally by humans, and is reawoken, and she's having post-traumatic stress disorder about what happened to the first one. No one at the company she works for really believes what happened in the first one. And then all of a sudden she discovers that the planet where they found the crashed ship in the first film has now been colonized in the 57 years in between the first and second films. And
just conveniently, just as she's arrived, there seems to be a blackout at the planet. I mean, imagine that odds.
I mean, it is convenient, but whatever. It's such a good movie that, yeah, I really don't care. So they find the ship, and all of a sudden they lose contact. So the company requests that Ripley accompany a group of Marines to go investigate what happened, and mayhem ensues. That's basically your basic synopsis of Aliens. But even more so than what happens in the film itself, Lee, like all of the Alien films, it seems like it has such a unique history of how the film got made. And as Lee mentioned, if you guys are able to track down the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, or if you come, because these documentaries were actually originally released when the 2000s DVD set came out, because I have both.
Yeah, that's right.
But if you track either of those down, they have really long, extensive documentaries on how each film got made, and they're really good watches. And Lee, I understand that in preparation for this show, you rewatched the one on Aliens.
Yeah, I certainly did. It's one of my favorite documentaries for so many reasons, because I think it's quite a fascinating insight into the clash of American and UK culture in making a film. For those who don't know, the Alien and Aliens movies, and I'm pretty sure Alien 3 as well, were filmed at Pinewood Studios, the home of James Bond. And it's a fascinating insight as James Cameron, this hardworking, totalitarian dictator almost of a director who's pushing for perfection all the time, comes up against British culture, which insists on having tea breaks every 10-15 minutes, which almost ties into the cliche that we're just a bunch of tea swiggers. And it's just so interesting to watch how the movie was made, the pressure they were under from everything, from what was going on behind the scenes to how close it got to the deadline. Famously, the movie is known to have a soundtrack that sounds remarkably similar to The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, well, there's a reason for that, obviously. Yeah. But let's break it down a little bit more, because the film, like I said, has such a fascinating history of how things happened. And the man we have to thank for this is really the director, James Cameron, because like many of his other movies, he not only directed, but he wrote the screenplay and the script. So he pitched the initial idea that kind of got Fox interested, and they wanted him to write it. They weren't so necessarily sold on him directing, if I remember correctly, because you guys have to remember, James Cameron is a name now, but back then he was kind of a nobody. Terminator had just come out, and I'm pretty sure it's so different today, but I'm pretty sure back in those days, when things were released, it wasn't like the wide releases that we have now. They were kind of released piecemeal, and word of mouth on opening weekend wasn't the instantaneous thing that we have now. It was kind of like it spread out over a few years. So yeah. Terminator was a hit, but it was a very, very modest hit for its budget. And the word on Cameron hadn't quite spread out there as quickly as it would today. So he, for all intents and purposes, he's kind of an unknown bet.
Yeah, because he tried to get a lot of the cast and crew to, well, more the crew than anything, the crew to watch a screening that he would put on of Terminator, because the crew weren't necessarily as trusting of him as they were of Ridley Scott. Obviously, there was a lot of crossover with the British talent pool, and they were like, oh, we, who is this guy? So he would try and put on screenings of Terminator on the lot so that people could watch. But ultimately, he wasn't the most... Not many of the cast would show up, so he really had to earn people's reputation, and they weren't like Ridley Scott was this, you know, the best man to them, and then to have someone new come, this American, there really was that culture clash. And you know,
well, you say American, he's actually Canadian, but yeah, the perception is...
Oh my god, then I can only apologize to Canadian listeners who continually have to live with people calling them American.
But he has, I would say that his work ethic is definitely American.
Oh yeah.
Not to say that Canadians are lazy. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I'm saying is that he's very, very controlling, and he's very, very perfectionist. He has a reputation, and they talk about this on the DVD, that he makes great movies, but he's not always the easiest person to work with.
No, you really would have to. He pushes people in a way that you can almost imagine if you're on board with him, like, you'll work hard for him, you'll do your best for him. But if he, you can almost imagine if he's pissed you off, some people would hold a grudge against him. And it seems that there was like quite a few people that would be involved on the crew that would be kicked off if they dared to cross the line with him.
Well, on one hand, though, I can kind of understand that, Lee, because I mean, if especially at this point in his career, if he's facing all this doubt, and people kind of don't really want him working on this project, the sequel to one of the most successful movies at that time, I mean, you have a lot to prove. And I kind of like his mentality of, you know, he pushes people, but I like the idea of him not suffering slackers, because no. I think that it shows in the end product whether or not you had a slacker on your crew.
In a way, Cameron was a stranger abroad, that he was... that. Cameron's gone on to be, you know, regardless of being Canadian, people probably think of him as American like me, because he's such a big part of the American film industry, that he's one of the pillars of it. And he's come over and he's shooting in and amongst British ideas, British crew and talent. And like, these people aren't
not
here
only
for
that
him.
Not only that, Lee, but the first movie was made by a British guy. So I get the sense watching the crew's reaction to him, Lee, and maybe I'm just kind of perceiving this wrong, but it just seems to me too that there was kind of a possessiveness with the Alien franchise. Like, no, this was made by our people. Who are you coming over to take over from Ridley Scott?
Because yeah, I almost have to think of at the time, and it can. We've touched upon it in a few podcasts that sometimes that there is that huge culture divide between the UK and the US, that the UK find that sometimes what would be classed as in most places in America as like being enthusiastic, passionate, really hard driven. In the UK, that's almost sometimes sneered at. Just that people need to be reminded of their place sometimes, and. I think that's the case here with James Cameron, that people were really against the idea of him, and that he was have to earn his place. He wasn't just going to be given. He wasn't just going to be given the keys to the kingdom that someone like Ridley Scott had to deserve. He had to be put under this trial by fire, essentially.
So I can understand where some of the pushback comes from on Cameron's part, because you're having to deal with an uncooperative crew, it seems like, because it's not just a culture clash. I mean, I remember things on the documentary that said that the crew would sometimes be actively defiant.
Yeah, and I think that was just, as I say, part of his trial by fire, that these crew, they were so used to doing things a certain way, having tea at a certain time, and someone like Cameron was really clashing against that, and it just seemed that Britain at that time perhaps was a bit more parochial in how they made movies. It was a bit more of a slower paced, and to have something like Aliens, which is almost kind of this huge big budget movie compared to say what Aliens was, that there was a lot more pressure on this movie, and that clashed with perhaps the more relaxed attitude of the British crew at the time. Obviously things have changed when you look at, think of Pinewood now with Bond and Star Wars really being based there, but in the 80s, it wasn't, that mentality wasn't there. So Cameron was essentially ahead of his time, whereas this British crew were stuck more in the kind of more traditional way of shooting that they'd probably picked up on the James Bond movies, for example.
Right. No, it makes sense. But there was a lot of clashing going on. I think at even one point, Cameron had to fire the first assistant director and get someone else on. I mean, it was tumultuous, but the film was able to get made, and I think that's I love seeing, you know, for lack of a less cliche term, art from adversity. So, but one thing Cameron is great at, and one thing that the documentary goes into extensively, is his casting. Mm-hmm. And Cameron, I don't think I've ever seen a James Cameron film where I could, you know, for whatever faults that it may or may not have, I've never seen a James Cameron film and said, well, that was poorly cast. I struggled to think of any. Especially when he was on his A game in the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, like, we always think of the movie and all these great characters and actors always string to mind. Like, I think it was probably the role that really made Bill Paxton and probably typecast him for a good few years.
Well, you know what? I said this with Tristan, but thanks to this movie and some of his other work with James Cameron, Bill Paxton is just a guy that whenever he pops up in anything, I get a little bit happier just because I really love his presence and his energy.
Yeah, like I was saying to my girlfriend the other day, I was like, if we ever get married, I want it put over like loudspeakers just before I say I do, just to have Bill Paxton's voice going, "Game over, man, game over." So he's just one of those people. He's probably the thing after Ripley and Newt that people always just take away from is definitely Bill Paxton.
Well, he's the one who gets all the quotable lines in this.
Oh yeah, and you can imagine like getting given that role, and you just go to town with it. Everyone in the crew, the crew really do embrace the role, and what must have been a hell of a difficult shoot that it doesn't show on the screen. There's just so much excitement, passion, and energy about pretty much every character. No one really leaves anything behind.
Right. Well, let's go through the characters really quickly, because we just talked about Bill Paxton, who plays Hudson, who is one of the best characters. But I do believe when the concept originally started out, they weren't necessarily sure how they were going to continue the story. And in some early conceptualizing, it wasn't even sure if they were going to bring back Sigourney Weaver. And it was Cameron who, when he started working on the screenplay, kind of insisted that Ripley had to be a part of the story, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would really have been so easy for them just to pick up with another story or another crew or another ship and do something that was really just a stone's throw away from what we already had. Whereas, like, that's why I almost think it's so difficult to compare the two movies. Like, which one do I like more? Because they're both hugely different. The only thing that's really consistent is some of the terminology, the kind of even the universe a little bit, and the aliens. But the fact that they've got these huge different realities, just they both take about, so when one's a haunted house movie, another's this Vietnam War movie, it's just he makes it his own so well.
Well, but the thing is that if we're looking at the character of Ripley in this film, Lee, I would argue that Alien, the first movie, made her a star. Mm-hmm. But Aliens made her and the character of Ripley an icon.
Yeah, you always think of her when she's got Newt on one shoulder, the flamethrower on the other, facing down the Queen. Like, that's as iconic as it comes. When we think of Ellen Ripley, that's the character we get, I think.
I either picture that moment or I picture her in the power loader with the "get away from her, you bitch," which is one of the best moments for women in film, I think. Yeah. But thank God that Cameron insisted that they keep that character in, because what they do with her in this film is so rich and so layered and takes it beyond what even you could imagine from the first movie. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, because her character gets even more layered depending on which cut of the film you see. And really quickly, before we go into the other cast members, Lee, I want to know which cut of Aliens you prefer, because me personally, I really prefer the special edition cut, the director's cut, because it adds her her daughter passing away in, and I think it gives more substance to her, the Newt and Ripley relationship. And not for nothing, because it's kind of a throwaway plot line, but I love in the director's cut the whole plot line with the sentry robot guns. That's not in the theatrical version. So which one do you prefer?
For all the reasons you've just mentioned there, it's the director's cut as well for me. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing it for the first time on a big screen.
Yeah, now I was going to ask you, are they going to show you the director's cut of Aliens?
Yeah, it's the director's cut of Alien and Aliens. All the screenings this week are the digital copy of those director's cuts. So yeah, I'm so excited.
So I do prefer the special edition director's cut.
Excellent. We're on the ball there.
But let's move on, because, you know, not only do we have Ripley in this film, we have her crew of Marines that she accompanies, and we kind of get to know a little bit about them at first, because, you know, a lot of them are going to die in the first encounter with the aliens. But we get to know a little bit about them. I end up just loving hanging around with these guys. But when we're talking about this film and the Marines, we're really talking about the people that we're stuck with for the majority of the film. And I don't mean to say stuck with, because it's not like it's a bad thing.
Yeah.
Our main group of Marines. So
yeah, the ones that survived that initial encounter, that just the tension just builds.
Correct.
And builds.
So we've kind of hit on Bill Paxton and Hudson. The other, big male lead of this is obviously Michael Biehn as Hicks.
Yeah.
And someone who was not originally cast in this film.
That's right, yeah. He was replaced, was it James? I can't
forget. James Remar.
James Remar, yeah. More known to folk nowadays as the dad ghost in Dexter. Yeah, he was replaced for, let's just say, had a bit of a thirsty nose for the powder.
Right. Michael Biehn obviously is an alum of James Cameron at this point. He had just played Kyle Reese in Terminator. And what he brings to this film, I think, is a sense of confidence, of grounding,
yeah.
Because everything is so chaotic around him that he and Ripley are the grounding force of this movie. And I love his leadership abilities. I love his skills. And I'll just be straight up front to you with you, Lee. I mean, when I was watching this movie in between my first and second years of university, it was kind of at that point where I was quote-unquote discovering myself.
Of course.
Michael Biehn is probably one of the first actors I had a major crush on. And it's mainly due to this film, but also kind of due to Terminator. So I really like watching him in this.
I won't mention to you, just to get you jealous, that I saw him in the flesh last year at a comic book convention.
I'm sure,
because
he does a lot of those. But
yeah, he's quite a regular on the circuit here.
But, I mean, how do you feel about the Hicks character?
Yeah, Hicks for me, I just find him that you need that when... To have someone like, say, Bill Paxton as Hudson, you need someone like Hicks that just levels everything out. That you can't have all these Colonial Marines as kind of jumped up characters. You need to have those different personalities and characters. And that's why I say Hicks, Hudson, and Vasquez complement each other so differently. They all have their own different energy. So that's why the Colonial Marines have been so well remembered. It's not just they're a band. It's like everyone's got their favorite. Oh, I love Vasquez for that scene. Oh, but I prefer, you know, Hudson for that, or I prefer Hicks for that. I really like that they all bring something different.
I mean,
to their
and it's just little things too, like the first time that Hicks really made an impression on me as a character, not only in the briefing scene where Ripley's talking to the Marines about what the mission is, but just little things like when they're going down in the dropship, like everyone, Elvis is hyped up and everything, and Hicks is just asleep. Because, and to me, that just says he's more badass than any of them, because all of this is so routine. Like, he's got this under control.
Yeah, and it's little things like that that show you that it's a fully grounded world, that these people have done it so many times. And you see it on just little touches that you see peppered through the movie with the kit, with the like stickers on the ship, that this is something they've kind of, not necessarily with the same aliens or anything, but they've done this stuff before. They're seasoned professionals. When I know my dad, for example, has to get a helicopter sometimes to his work, and he manages to fall asleep, whereas if it was me, I'd probably be geared up and I'd be like, oh, I'd be kind of always alert. But if you've done it so many times, it's, you know, it's just kind of part of the norm. So it really gives, it doesn't say much, but it shows a lot about these characters.
I think it says a lot with showing very little.
I got myself fairly muddled up there. I must still be on the drink from last night.
But I love Hicks, and let's talk about the other one that you mentioned, the person who's never been mistaken for a man, Vasquez.
Yeah. She's definitely brilliant, and to have not one but two iconic female characters in a movie like this is just something else.
And it's so funny because you look at Vasquez and she's, the character is supposed to be, very, very Latina. And then you look at the actress and she's anything but, white Jewish woman. But no, Jeanette Goldstein does a great job with the character and totally transforms. And like I said, her first line, first exchange in the movie when Hudson says, "Have you ever been mistaken for a man?" She goes, "No, have you?" it's one of my, I immediately fell in love with that character.
Yeah, she's such an iconic character, and I really love everything about her, that she's, she's just one of the guys. It's not, the fact that she's a woman really makes little difference. It's, as you say, that line there,
she's tougher than all of them except for maybe Hicks.
Oh yeah, and she's no messing around, and I think she's fantastic in the role. And I was actually listening to another podcast recently where it was talking about, she spoke about what it was like filming on Aliens and all these different things, and they were like, "Oh, so what do you do nowadays?" And she goes, "Oh, I own a lingerie shop in Los Angeles." So I'm sure that her experience as a colonial marine has prepared her for fussy customers right. in LA.
Well, it's so funny because could you ever picture that Vasquez is the same woman who plays John Connor's stepmother in Terminator 2?
No, absolutely not. And she plays the communications officer.
The science officer on the Enterprise B,
Yeah.
You would never recognize her, though, unless you were looking for it.
She's definitely got one of those roles that you think of all these iconic roles, and it's a shame that she's never really been able to make, say, a huge career, that she's always maybe been that person that, oh, I recognize her from that thing. She's never, I wish she was a breakout star as much as Bill Paxton had been and say Sigourney Weaver had become.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but man, what a character to have in your resume though, huh?
Oh yeah, and that's the sort of thing that people will always remember for and stuff. And if you're going to be remembered for one role, that's not a bad one to be remembered for.
And not for nothing, I will say out of all of them, Vasquez has the best death scene in the film.
Oh yeah,
I mean, blowing herself up with the lieutenant with the grenade, I love it.
Yeah, like the fact that she takes one for the team, and in those last few moments with Vasquez, and is just it's such a well written part. Like, in the hands of someone else less capable, these people would have just all been jocks. They wouldn't have had much personality or character. But this fact that someone like Vasquez can show such heart and soul in those last few moments is such a testament to the writing. It could have been lazy, but it was so well refined.
Right. And let's talk about a character that serves as a contrast to the first film, Lee. In the first film, we had Ian Holm as Ash, who ended up being an android who was very cold and calculating and a killer, really. And here we get Lance Henriksen as Bishop, who I love what they do with Bishop in the sense that Ripley doesn't trust him simply because he reminds her too much of Ash.
Quite right. But
throughout the film, they kind of tease, oh, is he good or is he not? Mm-hmm. But I love what they end up doing with the character, and Lance Henriksen's performance really infuses a lot of humanity into a non-human character.
Yeah, I think he's... And it's the thing that we keep coming back to with all these characters, he's just so iconic, that scene with the knife where he's just doing it between the hand and stuff, and just even to up until
which,
his little
which is
death
which is
scene.
It's really him doing that, by the way. He said on the commentary he practiced that.
It's just such an incredible role, and that's you keep coming back to all these chapters, and you could always say everyone, oh, that's so iconic. Oh, everyone has these amazing moments and roles that. And I always think Bishop, for me, is one of my favorite android characters from the entire series, and that has so many fantastic ones, excluding Alien Resurrection. He's such a cracking character, and he gets so many great lines as well.
Yeah, I mean, just that they were able to humanize that character so much to the point where, like I said, when they bring his destroyed corpse back for Alien 3, it's a heart-wrenching scene just because I love that character so much.
And it's just, he's, but it's just the humour behind him as well, and that he's got so many little... He's almost like a kind of prototype to Data that we get in a way, that kind of droll comedy that he says all with such a straight face, and that we see him almost over the course of the movie become a little bit more human. That arc is just really good.
Right. I mean, one of my favourite little moments, and again, little things that the actors do, is when Bishop volunteers to go out and... redirect the satellite to bring the other dropship down, and he, you know, everyone's saying, oh yeah, he should go, and then he has that line about, I'd really rather not. I may be synthetic, but I'm not stupid. And he just does this little quick smile thing, and like I said, that little moment just brings so much humanity to the character.
Yeah, like every one of them has that humanity and character, and you know, I think of someone like hopefully I'm getting Apone, current Colonel.
Apone, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he's not in it that long, but what he is in it for is so funny.
Yeah, it's always like for me, like it's like the writing, the casting, it's so well, like even the little roles like that really stand out. You know, it's another glorious day in the Corps. Like, it's something that we're all quoting all these years.
His stuff with Hudson, come here.
Yeah. What are you, Hudson? Get on the ready line. And it's just, I think, as great as Alien is, I think having aliens always brings up almost that when people talk, oh man, I love Alien. Part of that is also because of Aliens. That Aliens was so good with these characters, and that they complement each other so well that we can almost take the two apart. So that the work of Aliens, like with this cast, makes people think how great Alien is even more, I think.
Right. And you know, we keep making parallels to Star Trek here. You know, Aliens to me is kind of like the Deep Space Nine, in the sense that not only does it have a great leading cast, the secondary cast is extraordinary.
And it also doesn't, and it also has a kid that's not annoying.
We should talk about that now, because child actors are one of the hardest things to cast, yeah, right, in anything, let alone this sci-fi action horror film. And it was so fascinating listening to the documentary on this, because, you know, when they were saying something to the effect of, when they were auditioning child actors, a lot of the child actors that they were seeing were primarily doing commercials.
Yeah.
So when they're auditioning these actors to play this little girl who has post-traumatic stress disorder, they kept smiling because they're so used to being in commercials, and it just wasn't appropriate for the character, because, like I said, this is a little girl who has seen things that no little girl is meant to see. So
exactly.
she has to be going through so much stress. And when they found Carrie Henn, who plays Newt, I mean, watching her performance on the screen, that she seems to be the one thing that people tend to complain about if they complain about anything in this film, but I think it's entirely unfounded, because I think she gives that character everything that character needs, and I really end up feeling for a child, which if anyone's listened to me on any various Star Trek show that I host, that's a big accomplishment in my book.
Yeah, Newt is so such a good character, and I like to think that a lot of that comes from the work she did with Sigourney Weaver, that someone like Carrie Henn really wasn't, she'd done a school play, and I think having someone that she had such a close relationship, like Sigourney Weaver, like someone that helped her through it, nurtured her, tutored her through all the roles, that I can't think of a better teacher for an acting role like that. And I think she should look back on that fondly, that sci-fi movies and TV shows is littered with terrible casting decisions with young kids, but I think for me that's one of the most iconic young character roles in a cinema ever, and you know, I think, say, fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, because so many child actors tend to play their parts as precocious, and she's anything but. She's subtle, she's nuanced, she brings a lot of a haunting quality to the character. I mean, I don't think I've ever been as impressed with a child performance in a adult movie the way that she is in this film.
Yeah, like it almost made me, like I think she's almost up there with Lex and Tim for me from Jurassic Park. I think people sometimes sneer at the character for the line, oh, they come at night mostly. And yeah, like, yeah, okay, I get that a little bit, but it's still a great line.
But you know, you have to remember that she's still a kid. She's had to mature in a very short period of time because of what she's had to go through. But I mean,
it's not her fault in the delivery either. It ultimately is just maybe just a bit of the character.
It is the character, because I mean, when Ripley first meets her, I mean, she picks up that picture of her to find out who she is, and she's a second grader. And for here in America, that's, you're in second grade when you're 6 or 7. So you're dealing with that age of a child. They're going to talk like that. And I thought it was in character. I thought it was fine.
Yeah, for me, I thought it was perfectly in character. I just think maybe the writing could have... Maybe they didn't need the second part of, mostly. But it's one of these things that sometimes that... I think people sometimes get caught up in the meme of things, that it's almost turned itself into a meme. And when people see that, they go, oh, that's that line. It's as opposed to when probably me and you watched, and when most people watched it, it's like, oh, that's a normal line, and yeah, that's all fine.
To me, that's not even her best moment, though. I think my favorite moment with Newt comes in the scene where Ripley's trying to put her to bed. Not at the end, at the kind of in the middle point where she, you know, she says, you're really tired, you probably should take a nap. And she gives the line about, my mommy always said there were no monsters, no real ones, but there are. Exactly. That scene is brilliant, I think.
I know, it really is. I think that she deserves so much credit for that role. Like, when you watch the behind-the-scenes stuff as well, you realize how horrific that must have been to be on that set, like to be such a young kid and have so much of this stuff going on, that she really has done such an incredible job to enjoy it and embrace it.
But when you watch Carrie Henn on those documentaries, because she is on there, the stuff was happening around her, but it sounds like she had a really good time on set and she had a good experience, especially with Sigourney.
Oh yeah, and I think Sigourney probably shielded her from a lot of the politics and the stresses of the set, that you can imagine how tough that must have been. I think one of my favourite stories is when she falls down the shaft. She purposely tried to screw it up
because
several
times.
Because
she had
too
much fun going down the slide, yeah.
Yeah, so that she could reenact, keep doing it over and over. And that James Cameron took her aside at one point and went, we've kind of got to do it properly now. So I think it must have been great fun to be on at times, but it must have been very stressful, and full credit to her for keeping her head.
I do love how he dealt with it, in the sense that if you do it properly, I promise you can go down the slide as many times as you want, because that's what he told her.
What a buzz that must have been to be on that set.
But all the Alien films end up having an antagonist, and we've got a real great one in this one, played by Paul Reiser as Carter Burke.
Yeah, I really like Burke. He's one of my favorite characters from... I could say this about everyone. He's another one of my favorite characters from this movie. I just find him...
He's so
I
sleazy,
almost look at him,
and I love him.
Yeah. And he's the everyman. He's the... You know, you look at the Colonial Marines, then these are people we all look up to. If there's any person that the viewer is in the movie, we're not Ellen Ripley, we're not Newt, we're not Bishop... Us, me, you, Matt, we're all probably a bit closer to someone like Burke, which makes it kind of relatable in a different way.
You're either someone like Burke, or if I was in that situation, I think I'd be closer to Hudson.
Yeah.
But yeah, Carter Burke, I mean, I think he might be my, I loved Ian Holm in the first one. Yeah. I think Carter Burke might be my favorite antagonist, just because he's more vulnerable than Ian Holm was, and because he's such a underhanded character. I mean, the scene everybody I think remembers with something that he did is him letting the facehuggers loose on Ripley and Newt.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, you watch him in the movie and you never really kind of think, you think this guy's a bit of a, you know, a douche, but you never think, man, he really is a bad guy. And that's the type of bad guy you want, that when it comes, it's deserved and stuff. It's not just something that's done for the sake of it, that he really, you're like, ooh, this, he is a truly good villain, because he's not Dick Dastardly, he's not shaking, he's not twirling the mustache, he's just kind of doing his job, and then things kind of get on top of him.
He's just, he's just kind of a scumbag. Yeah. And, he, of course, he gets the best, he gets a really deserving death scene.
Oh yeah.
But speaking of which, have you ever watched, there's a deleted scene where actually he came back after his quote-unquote death scene, and it's when Ripley is going into the atmospheric processor to save Newt, and she ends up, there was a deleted scene where she ends up running into Burke, who's cocooned on the wall, and he said he's obviously already been face hugged, and he asks Ripley to help her, and all Ripley does is give him a grenade, implying that he should blow himself up. Have you ever seen that? Because that's kind of fun.
I have, and I think they made the right decision cutting it out. I think almost having what almost comes across like two death scenes just takes away a bit of the punch. So
I agree.
I think that the decision they made was the best. And for some, whenever I watched Alien, and then I used to see what was that Mad About You that he was in?
Yeah,
and
Mad
I
About You.
Sometimes see it on TV, and I was like, wait, that's Burke. He's almost like this totally different character. He's this comedy character. I was like, you know, it was something I never really saw coming when so I think the role of Burke's a cracker.
He kind of was a comedy character at this point, because I think the only movies that he was well known for before Alien was that he was Eddie Murphy's friend in the first Beverly Hills Cop movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But great performance. But let's talk about the unsung hero of this movie, and someone whose work is always going to be iconic. And you brought up Jurassic Park earlier, Lee, and he worked on that as well. I'm talking about Stan Winston, the effects guy for this film.
It's hard not to romanticize Aliens and his involvement, that when you watch the behind the scenes and you're watching this movie and you see all the amazing work with models and backgrounds, it's a time that I loved looking back on as like a film geek and, you know, a science fiction fan. His influence is just second to none, and what he did with the aliens is just amazing.
I don't think people realize like what kind of things this man brought us, because this is the guy who designed the design for the Terminator endoskeleton.
Yeah.
He designed the Predator. He designed the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. And, you know, for this film, obviously he gets to do his own take on Giger's original work from the first one. But obviously his biggest contribution to the Alien franchise is the Queen. Yeah, and when you watch the film and you look at the, you know, obviously it's an old school puppet, but she looks so badass and cool. And it's one of the best monster designs I think I've ever seen.
Yeah. Like, we compare it to, we've seen CGI aliens kind of quite a bit since, and none of them ever have looked as good as what they do in Aliens. And, like, the fact that, you know, Stan Winston, God rest his soul, been gone for a good few years now, but, like, that legacy he had is just unparalleled. And I really think someone like him will be remembered forever, that, as you mentioned, so many of those amazing roles there, that he's just as amazing as anyone else in this movie, that, yeah, we don't see him, but God, what a performance him and the team did.
Because let's talk about it, that scene where Ripley saves Newt and then accidentally stumbles into where the Queen is. It not only is it such a good scene, but when you see just the full size of the Queen, and you know how slimy she looks and how spider-like and intimidating she is, I mean, let's talk about the design, because I think it's incredible. I think it holds up too.
It's little things, from even the transparent teeth, and it's the size, and the model had two men inside pulling things away. And nowadays it would have been so easy to have just do CGI, but back then these people really had to use their talents to get it all completed. They had to use men and puppets. They had to use cranes, and it looks to this day, and I've seen it on the big screen so many times, and it still looks incredible. And it's unrivaled, really, for creature work. And that's something pretty special to see when you think of the movies that Stan Winston has also done since.
I just love it. And of course, I love the final confrontation on the ship between her and the Queen and the power loader.
And what another iconic moment that is. I mean, that's what we keep coming back to, that for me to say that, despite that Alien, that's my favourite of the two, but to fact that I keep saying, oh, I love this character, what an iconic moment. And it's not a cliche, it is such an iconic moment. It's like probably Star Trek and Star Wars, people can name some of these things from Aliens without even probably having ever seen it. And that power loader scene, step away from her, you know, finish it yourself. It's just incredible, that scene, and the soundtrack from James Horner.
Yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to finish, Lee, before we went into final thoughts on the film, because this is, you know, James Cameron usually ends up working with, especially in these early days, with Brad Fidel, who did the Terminator score, and he scores, I think he does The Abyss. He obviously does Terminator 2, and I believe he also did True Lies.
That's right.
But for this one, he ended up working with James Horner, who at the time had just scored Star Trek 2 and 3. And because of the time crunch with this film, like you alluded to, the score had to kind of be rushed, and so you end up using some cues from 2 and 3 Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But the stuff that he comes up with for this film, this, when I think of James Horner, I mean, of course I think of his Star Trek stuff, but I think mostly about this film. Yeah. And I'll tell you why. It's because some of the cues that are original to this film, I think, are pretty fantastic. My favorite parts of the score for me are what plays when Ripley goes in to rescue the Marines with the APC during the first encounter.
Yeah.
And the biggest piece of score that I think people will remember from this film, and it's my personal favorite, is the score that plays twice. Once when they're escaping at the end before the explosion, just that build up with the drums and the mm-hmm. and the horns, and it plays again when she dumps the queen out of the airlock.
Yeah.
That piece of music is so iconic, and I've heard it used in trailers since.
Oh yeah.
But what James Horner was able to come up with under the gun is still fantastic, and I think of this score particularly because. And you can kind of hear it in the Star Trek 2 and 3 score, but here, in this score specifically, he was a big fan of clanging metal sounds, and you get a lot of that in this film.
And it complements the movie so well. I mean, it really is that when you watch the behind the scenes, that this is a guy that had less than 6 days due to the production overrunning to get this score made, and it is an incredible score. I feel so privileged. I'm getting the chance to see it the day after I'm seeing a Jurassic Park showing at the Albert Hall, where they're going to be performing with a live orchestra the Aliens soundtrack to the live movie.
That's so cool.
So it's going to be Jurassic Park on the Saturday and Aliens on the Sunday, so I can't believe my luck that it's one after another, essentially. So James Horner, you know, I was so sad when he passed away.
I know, but you know what? The first things I listened to were the Star Trek score and the Alien score.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, he's just someone that's going to live on forever. And it's so fascinating that this, despite that getting the Oscar nomination and essentially possibly being the soundtrack that really gave him his name out with to the kind of mainstream, this was a guy who was really hurt by the process of making Aliens, how it all went so wrong. And he wasn't impressed with the time he had to do the score, but it's the same that we've cut back to so many times with this movie, that we've talked about iconic, but we've also talked about art from adversity, that they've managed to make this amazing iconic score in 6 days. Yeah, he's maybe had to copy some of his own previous score and put a little twist on it, but can I blame him for the time he had? No, not really. And what a score it is.
So we've kind of broken down like all of the essential parts of this movie and what makes it the unique sequel that it is. So as we wrap up here, Lee, what do you take away mainly from this second film? And I guess for you, what are you looking forward to most about seeing it on the big screen again in a few days?
Yeah, I mean, this will be one of my kind of third or fourth time I've seen Aliens on the big screen.
Have you ever seen it with the live orchestra, though?
No, that'll be in November time, so
okay.
I'm very excited for that.
I thought that was in a few days. Okay.
No, I've got quite a while to wait for that, but I'm so excited because it's one of those movies that I've seen it so many times now on the big screen, VHS, DVD, Blu-ray, special edition DVD, and it's those words I keep mentioning. It's iconic, it's inspirational, it's ahead of its time, it's art from adversity. There's so much on a technical level to admire, there's so much on an artistic level to my character wise that it's a film that I love. Like Alien, I was one movie that I think's the best of the two, but if I really want to just sit back on a Sunday and watch a movie, I want to spend it in the company of the Colonial Marines, Ellen Ripley. It's just an amazing movie. And I was thinking the other day that with Cameron announcing that he's going to be doing 4 Avatar sequels, I was like, man, I'd love to see some more movies from James Cameron. That's something a bit different, you know. Then it feels like it's such a waste of the talent that he's got. I'd love to see him doing 4 original movies or any passion projects, just something a bit different. And Cameron made an iconic movie here, and the fact that we are talking about it all these years later, we're talking about all these different characters, and some of them, of these actors, never did little much else beyond it. Some of them have gone on to star in some of the biggest movies ever, people like Sigourney Weaver and Bill Paxton, but everyone remembers them for Aliens, and boy, what a movie. It's a glorious day in the core whenever I get to watch it.
So yeah, Lee, I'm going to echo a lot of your sentiments with my final thoughts on the film. To me, this is one of those movies where I have to say, it's, if it's not the perfect sequel, it is one of the most perfect sequels of all time. And what makes it so special is everything we've discussed, from the characters to the writing to the music to where they took the story. Everything coalesced in this film. And I think it's a great credit to James Cameron that he was able to, as we said throughout the course of this podcast, take all the adversity that he was facing from the crew, the all the grips and all that sort of stuff, and make it truly a work of art, which is something that I don't say about every single film that's made. And this movie is so near and dear to me. It's there's not much more I can say other than it's special. And I even just talking about it with you in this last hour, I want to see it again. Now
Tuesday can't come quick enough.
I'm so looking forward to hearing your report on that. I'll share mine as well. But in the meantime, Lee, thank you so much for taking the time to discuss this incredible film on its 30th anniversary. I can't believe, 30 years, and it's really aged so well. So thank you so much for joining me with this.
No worries. It's always a pleasure. So, if you want to catch us online, where can people find you, Matt?
They can find me at mhanson0207 talking about Alien and all other kinds of nerdy stuff.
And if you ever want to catch me, I'm Lee_Nostromo, appropriately enough. So, yeah.
Until we really appreciate you joining us for this special look back at Aliens. And until next time, we're on an express elevator to hell, going down.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
This spring, you'll find inspiring choices at DFS. Everything from armchairs to loungers, two-seaters, sofa beds, high backs, pillow backs, recliners, chaise longues, and corner sofas with built-in storage in sky blue, grey, ruby, teal perhaps. If you're quick, all new season spring collection sofas are half price, available with 4 years interest-free credit. And because they're all handmade to order in your choice of style and colour, you're sure to find the perfect one. Savings on selected sofas end Monday. DFS, not percent APR representative.